on this Earth Day. Welcome into Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The world's 1.4 billion Catholics, including about 1.5 million in our region, are in mourning. The head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, died on Monday. He was 88 years old. And from the very start of his papacy, he made history. He was the first Jesuit pope, the first from Latin America, first non-European pope in over 1,200 years. He spoke the language of mercy and humility. Pope Francis welcomed the marginalized. He challenged the rich. He drew praise as a modernizer and criticism as too ambiguous. So today, we'll break down the life, legacy, and leadership of Pope Francis. We'll remember his visit to Philadelphia in 2015. I was a reporter then, covered it. Definitely a highlight of my career, and it was a landmark moment for the city and the country. We have a panel of guests with differing views on the church, and we'll also discuss what the Catholic Church may look like in the future and how it could impact the world and the rest of us. So our question of the day is, did Pope Francis change the way you view the Catholic Church? What do you think he'll be remembered for? And what should the church do next? You can call us and weigh in. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comments in the chat.
And again, those questions, did Pope Francis change the way you view the Catholic Church? What do you think he'll be remembered for? And where should the church go next? Big question. Studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories. And we'll start in New Jersey / New York, where we got sort of the final chapter, potentially, on a bribery case that has shaken up New Jersey politics. Nadine Menendez, the wife of former New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, was convicted yesterday on 15 counts in a federal bribery case. We won't go back through all the details, but this was the case that involved the importation, well, involved a lot of things, including the importation of halal meat from Egypt and what has now been proven to be a type of quid pro quo scheme to help some businessmen and for the Menendezes to receive compensation as a result. Again, Nadine Menendez now convicted, her husband already convicted in a federal trial.
Yeah, she was accused of being an intermediary between her husband and foreign officials. And they said that she set up meetings early on when the couple was only dating. And her trial had been pushed back. They were supposed to be tried in fairly close proximity to one another. But she was diagnosed to breast cancer, had to undergo treatment. And now she'll be sentenced in June.
Yeah, so she's headed to prison, her husband headed to prison, barring some sort of unforeseen turn of events. But, you know, this was a pretty shocking corruption scandal that I would hazard to say didn't really break through the news cycle the way it might have 10 or 15 years ago. I think people have become a bit numb to these types of things.
And there's so much going on as well.
There's a lot going on in the world. But when you look at the details of this case, it was pretty brazen what the prosecutors ultimately proved, which is that they basically got cash and cars and gold bars in exchange for helping these businessmen make money themselves off of their scheme involving the country of Egypt. So, I mean, it was a pretty, again, brazen case of corruption that I don't think will be all that remembered, or I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it, given the details of the case and just how shocking they are.
And I'm always reminded this was the senator, former senator's second corruption trial. The first one he was able to overcome, this time not so much. Moving on, college newspaper editors are seeing an uptick in requests from international students who are asking to remove or alter published articles out of fears that the articles will attract the attention of ICE and possibly risk their legal status in this country.
Wow.
Yeah. The requests, of course, come at a time when the U.S. government has revoked over 1,000 international student visas nationwide. Typically, student-run newspapers would say no to this type of removal request, But now student journalists are balancing the duty to record history and the need to protect their peers. They have started removing author names from stories related to sensitive topics like Israel or Gaza to prevent potential repercussions. And some campus papers have changed bylines to simply staff or advise international students to now write anonymously.
And I want to credit the Inquirer for this story. They're the ones that put this together and did the digging on it. It's a fascinating story. This is not a new issue for journalists. It's the context that's new. But for those who are not in our field, you know, this has been a long time issue for people who are accused of crimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That their name or their face or both gets put in the paper. Then if they're later exonerated, often the record still exists of the arrest. And when you Google, and this has really become a big issue with Google, mm-hmm. when you Google someone's name it and the first thing that pops up. Mm-hmm. So there's actually been some really interesting efforts. I want to say it's out of Cleveland to revisit stories that were published to look about, to see whether or not they should be revised or removed based on the facts that happened after the charge or the arrest. And it's a real tough push and pull because newspapers are supposed to be the first draft of history, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, you don't sort of remove the fact that something happened. Someone said something, someone is accused of something. That's still part of the record of history. These are such tough cases and even tougher now. I mean, this is such a difficult issue.
And it is. And I mean, Avi, I teach journalism, law, and ethics. I talk about this all the time. Yeah. And, you know, these J schools are training grounds for future journalists, right?
Yeah.
And so they're asked at this stage of their career to change the rules, to say, you know what, do I protect my fellow journalists? Do I protect other students? Because we don't know how that information is going to be used. And so a lot of them have been leaning in that direction because this is their colleague. This is their fellow student. And they don't want to see more students lose their visas. By the way, at least 5 students at Temple University lost their student visas. And the reason there is unknown. But these student journalists don't want that hanging over their heads or consciences. They don't want to be the person who causes that.
Moving now to our third story. This is big breaking news, Cherry.
Oh.
A Jersey Shore company says it has revolutionized mozzarella sticks.
Oh, okay.
And they just pulled in some major cheese on the ABC show Shark Tank.
Revolutionized.
Now, Shark Tank, be ready. The revolution is coming. The mozzarella stick revolution, it's already here. It's not coming, okay? Mm-hmm. So Shark Tank, by the way, is the show where people pitch their ideas for a product to a panel of business people. And on Friday, one of the pitchers was Mike Houck, who co-founded an Atlantic City company called Mad Mutts.
Hey, yo, Sharks. My name is Mike Houck, and I'm from New Jersey. In Jersey, we're known for being cheesy, but today, it's a different kind of cheesy. I'm talking about Mad Mutts fresh mozzarella sticks.
Mozzarella sticks you can heat at home. They say a far superior cheese quality than what you usually get, and they come in many exciting flavors, Cherry, including chimichurri and a very spicy kind of mozzarella stick called Lucifer.
I love the name. Look at it. If you're watching
looks
on
scary.
YouTube, it looks pretty scary there.
So one of the sharks apparently bit and gave them $150,000 to invest in Mad Mutts, which is now on its way to leading the mozzarella stick revolution.
By the way, I think that's pretty cool. I liked how they leaned all the way in. Mike had on neon green spiked hair wig and goggles and a lab coat to go with this mad scientist look. I love that. And, you know, I love Shark Tank, by
is
the
that
way.
Is that typical on Shark Tank?
They love owners of businesses and entrepreneurs who lean all the way in and are the best salespeople for their product. And I feel like he nailed it.
I mean, I guess I would find then the market inefficiency is boring people, and I would invest
they care
in their
about
companies.
The numbers too.
I would invest in those companies. You're bad at pitching, but your product is good. No one's going to bid on you. That's great.
I'll give you some cash.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this got me thinking because these people think that they have made a better mozzarella stick for you to heat up at home. Mm-hmm. What is a food that you think we need a better version of to heat up at home?
I feel like tacos and burritos.
That's
they
a
need
good
a
one.
Better one because
yes.
a lot of times yes. you get the tacos and burritos and they get soggy and they're not good. So I feel like I would invest in something like that if they could really get a good frozen one that you could put in the air fryer or the microwave and it would be excellent. Yes.
Yeah. Mad burritos.
Yeah, yeah.
Banging burritos.
Banging burritos.
Okay.
What you got?
It's a little offbeat. Jamaican patties. Can you get those frozen?
Yeah, you can.
Can you?
They're not always the greatest, though.
Are they a little soggy?
Sometimes they can be.
I love Jamaican patties.
Yeah,
and I feel like that would be a great reheatable if they had a really good version of it that you could put in your microwave or your air fryer.
Yeah, you would have to do it in the air fryer if you wanted to be even a little bit decent at this point. But that's a good one. I love those patties. Yeah.
One more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to those carts on the street, the halal carts,
mm-hmm.
and they give you a platter of rice with chicken on top or falafels. What about like a frozen version of that, like a reheatable version of that?
Falafel, yeah.
Yeah, like the whole platter, though, you know, you just heat it up. I'm not trying to put the halal guys out of business, but sometimes you can't, you know, you're working from home.
Yeah.
You can't go to the halal cart.
And I got to throw one more in there.
Okay.
I have not tasted good wings that are ready made. They always are very mushy to me.
No, see, you got greedy. You flew too close to the sun. They will never make a reheatable wing that tastes anything
like... They're not
good.
They're like mushy and it doesn't taste like real chicken to me.
You will never... No, you gotta... A wing has to be made the proper way in a restaurant. So you got greedy.
Yeah, I did.
You know what? You had a good idea. Burritos, tacos, keep it basic. And then you went for wings. I'm sorry. It's never going to happen. By the way, they've been working on pizza for a long time. And I still feel like they could improve
That needs some work, for sure.
All right. Let's transition now to our main topic, which is the recent passing of Pope Francis and where the Catholic Church is heading now. What do you think Pope Francis will be remembered for? What do you think the church should do next? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat.
He really was an ambassador for the world. You know, to me, I just feel like, just love. I feel like he just watched Philadelphia, you know, and he had Philadelphia in his arms and a father of Philadelphia, in essence.
I associate joy with Pope Francis, but also understanding and openness.
I just think he was for the people. It didn't matter who you were.
His family values for the world, and everybody was just so good. I'm sorry.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Pope Francis died Easter Monday at the age of 88. Our producer, Andrea, spoke with parishioners at the Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul yesterday as they exited the midday mass dedicated to the head of the Catholic Church. The voices you just heard were Kelly from Philadelphia, Barbie from Franklinville, New Jersey, and Abigail from Peru.
People all around the world are mourning the death of Pope Francis, often called the People's Pope, for his humility and outreach to poor and marginalized communities. Many saw him as a great reformer who modernized some of the church's views to make it more welcoming and inclusive.
But some of those views angered more traditional members of the Catholic Church, including some in leadership, especially on issues related to migrants, capitalism, and the LGBTQ community. In 2023, he allowed priests to bless same-sex couples.
So today, we're going to take a look at the life of this complicated figure who touched the lives of billions of people. What is his legacy, and where does the Catholic Church go from here? We have two great guests with us in the studio. Massimo Fagioli is a professor of theology and religious studies at Villanova University. Massimo, welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Michael Moreland, a professor of law and religion at Villanova University. Go Wildcats. Michael, welcome to Studio 2.
Glad to be with you.
And for those of you listening at home and online, did Pope Francis changed the way you view the Catholic Church? What do you think he'll be remembered for, and what should the church do next? Those are the questions of the day. We invite you to call in 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, please leave your comments in the chat.
So you guys just heard that whole windup, all that intro. And I'm curious, I'll start with you, Massimo. Like, do you think that's an accurate appraisal of Francis's legacy? It often gets put on this left-right spectrum here in America. Or what do you think is his main legacy?
I think his main legacy is that he's the first pope of the third millennium who really brought Catholicism into its global dimension, no longer a European franchise, no longer made or shaped by white men, open to the complexities of being a person on the margins of the world centers of power, of Rome, of Berlin, of New York. He was the perfect man to do that, and he did that with extraordinary ingenuity and energy and insight. And I think he was really the first pope of this very more complicated globalized Catholicism, which is a mix of encounter and disruption and tensions.
Michael, same question to you. What do you see as his main legacy? Massimo says sort of taking this institution that had been really rooted in the West and globalizing it. Agree? Disagree? Do you have another take?
I think that's basically right. I mean, he obviously had a very warm, welcoming personality that I think won a lot of people over. People mentioned his visit to Philadelphia in 2015, which was certainly a highlight of the local church here. So I think that was a remarkable aspect of his papacy and something that will live on. I think in terms of the overall legacy, it's complicated, and we'll see. I think in some ways he probably wasn't as liberal as his liberal fans might have hoped he was. Yeah. And maybe he wasn't, quite as, he didn't realize all the fears that some people of a more conservative bent had. But, it's a time now of mourning, and there'll be a funeral on Saturday, and then the church will start the business of thinking about his legacy, but then also what comes next.
I want to rewind back to 2013. And the time before Pope Francis was selected to lead the Catholic Church. I want you to sort of take me back to what the church was dealing with at the time to make Pope Francis the choice. Massimo, if you could start with that.
So it was an extraordinary conclave because it was the first time in 600 years that a conclave followed not the death of the Pope, but the resignation.
Yeah.
And so we should step back a little because no one expected a pope to resign, which is what Pope Benedict did when he was in relatively good health still. Mm-hmm. And so by resigning, Pope Benedict basically called what in politics we called a snap election. So he didn't give time to organize and so on. And so the conclave of 2013 chose the man who had been the runner-up of Pope Benedict 8 years before. And it was very extraordinary because every conclave is a uniquely intense moment, but also you had this cohabitation of the old pope and the new pope. So that was, for me as a scholar, incredibly interesting because we had never seen anything like that.
Yeah, but what was the church, and Michael, you can sort of like, what was the church dealing with? Because I think a lot has happened. We've had a, time warp with the COVID-19 pandemic. Politics have shifted, but take us back to that time. What were some of the forces at play that made Pope Francis the logical choice?
Well, I think certainly the church in this country and in other parts of the world was dealing with the continuing fallout from the sex abuse crisis and the efforts to grapple with that by first John Paul II and then Benedict XVI and now Pope Francis. So that was kind of one of the issues that was at least, I think, partly in the air. But also the fact that they went to a pope who was not European, who was from Latin America, an Argentine, I think was remarkable and showed, as Massimo said earlier, showed an effort on the part of some members of the College of Cardinals to broaden the kind of the reach of the church into the third world, into parts of the world where popes hadn't come from for forever. And so I think those are some of the issues. But then there's also this, and I do think it's important to emphasize the ways in which, the ecclesial politics of the Catholic Church don't map easily onto our kind of left-right divide.
Yeah, could you get into that? Because so many of our commenters are like, I loved it, his liberal vision, his inclusive vision, using words like progressive. I mean, that is something that I think it is really hard for us to view the politics of anybody outside of the context of our own politics. So let's dig into that a little bit.
I think that's right. And so, in the conclave of 2013, of course, you had every or almost every cardinal elector was appointed by John Paul II or Benedict XVI, and then they elect a cardinal who was perceived then and it certainly is perceived now as being more progressive. But again, progressive in what sense?
Yeah.
So sure, he raised the profile of issues like climate change, for instance, mm-hmm. or immigration and things like that. He had, I think, a kind of Latin American reflexive anti-Americanism toward the United States in some respects. But then on the other hand, he was strongly pro-life on questions about abortion and euthanasia, and certainly on questions where I think some of his liberal, quote-unquote, or more progressive supporters were hoping he would go, say, with regard to the ordination of women to the diaconate, he's kind of shut that down at a
certain
point.
Was he more words than actions? I feel like I've seen some of those reflections recently that his perception is based oftentimes on what he said, and that he was a little bit more liberal, using that term differently, with his approach to the press. So he just talked more extemporaneously, but that his actions didn't necessarily fit with his words. I mean, what do you think, Massimo?
So he was a liberal in the 19th century sense of the word, meaning that he believed that doctrine can develop, but doctrine is still important. Okay, so while liberalism for us means that sometimes who cares about doctrine, right? Right. I mean, it's an emphasis on individual freedom. So you're right. So his openings were verbal acts, which means that he didn't have time to catch up with his own words. But at the same time, and I've seen this as a practitioner of the theological discipline, he lifted the taboo, the veil, the threats that for decades was there. We cannot talk about certain things.
Yeah.
If you talk about certain things, you will get into trouble. This is no longer there because Francis said, we can talk about everything. And in the end, someone will decide. I, Pope, will decide on some issues. But that has really lifted a very heavy burden from some members of the church, not just theologians, but also gay Catholics, for example, women. So that was a more than a rhetorical act, had consequences in the life of people.
Hmm. And I think about the church, and Karen says, I liked him for his compassion and his humanity. Plus, he was great on the dance floor.
What?
That's what Karen said about him. I've never seen the Pope dance, but I think about what people were feeling inside the church. Membership was down. You know, there had been those years of scandal, and people, he was the kind of Pope when he was in leadership in the church, he rode the bus, right? And people felt that he was just like them. He wasn't just someone in a robe that was away from them. And can you talk about that a little bit, Michael, like this appeal to the common man and this desire to pull people back into the Catholic Church?
I think that's right. He came from a background that, so his two predecessors, John Paul II and Benedict XVI, were both at one time university professors and came from a much more kind of academic background before they were bishops. Whereas Francis was a Jesuit, which was first Jesuit Pope ever, and was a spiritual director and led the Jesuits in Argentina for a time. So he came from a background that was more pastoral, that was, if you will, kind of, you know, with ordinary folks in a certain respect. And so I think that was some of the attractiveness of him as a candidate in the conclave, and then you saw that in his papacy, the way in which he had this kind of, again, warmth and approachability to him with people and the disabled and the outcast.
Let me bring in a caller now. This is Trish from Newport, Delaware, who is on the line. Trish, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I guess my comment is this idea of talking about him and liberal and conservative and political spectrum, how close did the man come to walking in the footsteps of Jesus? And he was humble, and he tried to spread love, and he cared about all people, and he cared about the entire planet. I mean, we need to discuss him more in spiritual terms rather than political.
Thank you for that perspective, Trish from Newport. And Massimo, you wanted to jump in on that comment. Yeah,
it's an excellent question. A great theologian of the early 20th century who got into trouble for saying that said that Jesus announced the kingdom and then instead we got the church. So being Pope means that you have to keep these two things together, right? And so one of the things that happened in church history is that in these last two centuries, more or less, the popes have become much less monarchs, kings,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and more bishops, which is not an obvious thing to happen, right?
Yeah, so, explain that. I don't understand that.
What does that mean?
That. Yeah.
What's the difference?
Well, if you look at how Pope Francis will be buried on Saturday, it will be a burial much more typical of a bishop than of a king, mm-hmm. right? And so it means very different things. So what, Pope Francis has accelerated this process that the leader of the Catholic Church is no longer the heir of the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. and it's the leader of a global Catholic Church. So this sounds like a slogan, but it means many very difficult institutional steps, cultural, imagination of what the Pope is about. So it takes a lot of time. And so all popes did that in a little their own ways in the 20th century. Pope Francis has accelerated because he comes from a church where if you want to be a credible bishop, you have to ride the bus. Mm. If you don't, you will not be seen as a rat. So it was not an odd choice for him. It was a natural choice.
Mm. Yeah, and I want to encourage our listeners to call in. Our questions of the day is, did Pope Francis change the way you view the Catholic Church? What do you think he'll be remembered for, and what should the church do next? You can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop your comment in the chat. I want to put up a photo because when Pope Francis came here to Philadelphia, he greeted inmates during his visit to the current Fromhole Correctional Facility in Philadelphia. And he was known to wash the feet of prisoners. I want to talk about what the meaning of that. When you talk about Massimo, you talk about these popes, past popes being viewed in this very highbrow kind of way, but you had this pontiff who was willing to go into prisons to talk to everyday people, to bring himself more earthbound. How did that represent a great departure from past papacies?
But it was a departure in the sense that he was more constant in doing this, because predecessors had done things mostly in secret, visiting prisons that we don't know about. Mm. And so Pope Francis made that, in this age of media, of ever-present news cycle and so on, he wanted that to be at the front of his persona, right? So the whole message is that being the Bishop of Rome is not being the successor of the last Roman emperor. He's one who tries to be like Jesus.
Mm. Yeah.
This is complicated.
Yeah, yeah. No kidding. Right.
Yeah.
So there's also this whole side of this of talking about the Catholic Church as an institution, Michael. This idea that you are also the steward of an institution that you are attempting to grow. How did Francis do in that regard? And where is the church headed in that regard? We know a little bit about what's going on here in America, but give us more of that global perspective. Is the church growing, atrophying? Where is it growing? Where is it declining?
Right. Well, the institution is there, as the caller suggested. It's there at the service of the gospel of Christ and to spread Jesus's message. It is true, though, that the church is facing some very severe headwinds, especially in certain parts of the world.
Yeah.
And I think that, whether one ascribes it to secularization or other kinds of forces at work, that especially in North America and most of Europe, that the church is growing smaller. And in fact, the kind of growth in the church in those parts of the world where it has had this difficulty tends to be in much more traditional forms of Catholicism, mm. Things like the Latin Mass and so forth. But then it's a more complicated story in other parts of the world, right? Latin America, the church faces this difficulty with regard to Protestantism and kind of a competition, as it were, and it's a crude way of putting it, but a kind of competition between the Catholic Church and various kinds of Pentecostal and other Protestant denominations. And then real growth in parts of Africa and in parts of Asia. And that will be an interesting story over the next several decades, the way in which the church is increasingly at least in terms of its demographic growth, is centered in places like Africa. So that, you know, I was recently, for instance, in places like Scotland and Ireland, where a lot of the priests are African now, because they have more vocations.
That's where people are joining
right,
the
clergy. And they have more vocations than almost than they need in parts of Africa. And so they're sending priests, including some to the United States as well. So that's an interesting demographic dynamic that, again, I don't think anyone expected that Pope Francis was going to kind of turn that all around, you know, suddenly, and that suddenly, you know, that all these forces would be quickly reversed that are many decades in the making. But that's kind of where I think the state of play is right now.
Yeah. Well, I want to bring in another guest that we have on the line right now. Pat Shiraki is a former news anchor for CBS Philadelphia, and she has covered Pope Francis and the Catholic Church extensively, including his 2015 visit to Philadelphia. Pat Shiraki is with us via Zoom to share some of her memories. Pat, welcome to Studio 2. It's a pleasure to see you and have you on the show.
Cherry, Avi, such a pleasure to be with you and also with Massimo and with Michael. I've been listening from the beginning of your discussion about the Holy Father's visit. And what has struck me is how real he always was. And certainly in Philadelphia, he came with open arms, and I really felt like an open heart to try to inspire and encourage not just the Catholic community, who certainly I felt were open enough to him in the beginning, but to everybody within the community. You know, one of the things that was so powerful for me was the day that he was elected, and he went out onto the balcony. So it was the same balcony that he said his last Happy Easter to my brothers and sisters message on Sunday, right before he died. He was on the balcony, and he bowed, and he blessed the crowd. But then he stopped, and he looked out, and he asked them, dear brothers and sisters, and he did this in Italian, what I ask you to do is to please take this moment and bless me. Bless your Pope, bless your bishop, so that I may go and do the work of God. And I was so struck at that moment. I was on the air when that happened. I watched that occur. And I said to the crew in front of me, wow, did you hear that? That is so completely different than anybody else. Mm. John Paul II came out with his open arms and said, do not be afraid. But this man, in his humility, asked for a blessing. And I feel like, and every time then, he would meet with people, whether it was in a big event, whether it was from that same balcony, whether it was from his window, whether it was from his hospital bed, what he asked for was for people to pray for him. But it wasn't to pray for his individual soul. It was to pray for him so he could do his work. And I think that work was about doing the work of Jesus Christ, leading with hope, that through faith, you can find hope.
And so,
and also with peace. And I feel like that's, and it wasn't, I mean, Cherry, it wasn't a PR package that somebody put together for him and saying, this is what you should do. This is who the man was. And we saw that in the simplicity of where he lived and then how he, even how he dressed.
Yeah, he did not, you know, he sort of shirked all the pomp and circumstance of the living quarters that popes usually have get to experience. But I want to take you back to 2015 when he came to Philadelphia. Do you have a moment from that time when so many, I mean, thousands of people gathered to witness him in the Pope Mobile? I don't know if people remember the little Jeep with the covering that rolled down the Ben Franklin Parkway. Could you take us to that time and what it was like in the city when Pope Francis came here?
Well, that the moment was so joyous, and it was so dynamic, and there were cheers everywhere he turned. But as we watched him get off the plane and then get into a Fiat, he asked the driver to stop not that far away. And I kept thinking, oh, my goodness, what's he going to do now? And what he did is he got out and he blessed a young man who was there with his family, who was clearly disabled, but he touched him. Mm. And that's what he continued, it blessed him and touched him. That's what he continued to do through the rest of the time that he was in Philadelphia. Every opportunity he had to draw a child close to him, to reach out and touch someone on their forehead, he did that. There was one moment, you were talking about his visit to Curran Fromhold. He said mass at the cathedral. He said mass on the parkway. He went to Independence Mall, where he spoke from the podium that Abraham Lincoln spoke from when he did the Gettysburg Address. But the moment that he went into Curran Fromhold, he went to meet the incarcerated. He went person to person, And what I noticed was there were times when he would lean in or the inmates would pull him close, in particular the women. But I did see it happen with the men, and he paused, and I could see the inmate speaking to him in his ear. And then he would pull back, he'd bless them, and he'd move to the next one. And I really wondered whether they were confessing a sin and asking for forgiveness. Because he was about a pope of forgiveness too. Yeah. And willing to accept everyone where they came from. And yeah. I think that that's part of also the reason for who are we to judge?
Yeah.
I think he didn't look at actions. He looked at souls. And I think that that, if we could see that as his true legacy, maybe we can do a better job too at walking in those footsteps and seeing souls before we see action.
Well, that was the wise words of Pat Shiraki, former news anchor for CBS Philadelphia, who covered Pope Francis and the Catholic Church extensively, including that unforgettable 2015 visit to Philadelphia. Pat Shiraki, thanks for joining us today on Studio 2.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And we're coming up on a break here, but let me read in a few more comments that are going to tee us up for the next segment. An email from Greg, who says, while Francis brought about positive changes in many ways as a longtime advocate for survivors of sexual abuse by Catholic priests, I must point out that for many survivors and advocates, he was a disappointment. Margie says, I love the fact that Pope Francis did not mince words with politicians, re-wars, immigration, or the environment. What do your guests think about the possibility of the cardinal from the Philippines being selected as the next pope? I am not Filipino, but I've noticed the devotion of Filipino Catholics worldwide. I believe this is the man some people describe as sort of the next Francis. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about all of that on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Keep those calls and comments coming, folks. 888-477-9499, Studio 2 at WHYY.org.
Where they go, I have no idea. Who, I'm sure that him being sick these last few weeks, that they do have some kind of idea where they're headed with this, but I have no idea. Just ask God that they find the right person for the job.
I think the church needs to continue with Pope Francis's footsteps in becoming more liberal and changing with the times.
I would like to see them go in the right direction, and love is the key. God is love.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You just heard from Mike, Maureen, and Lisa from Philadelphia speaking to our producer, Andreas, yesterday at the Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul. And we're continuing our conversation about Pope Francis's legacy and the mark he made on the church and on the world. Many non-Catholics also felt strong affinity for him and saw him as a moral leader. Our question to you is, did Pope Francis change the way you view the Catholic Church? What should the church do next? The number to call is 888-477-9499. You could email studio2@whyy.org.
Let me reintroduce our guests. We have Michael Moreland, a professor of law and religion at Villanova University, and Massimo Fagioli, a professor of theology and religious studies, also at Villanova University.
I want to read this comment from Elizabeth, and then I'm going to bring in a caller. So I want you to think about what Elizabeth has to say. She says, I was raised Catholic, and I found the Pope to be an incredible breath of fresh air. I think, however, given the conservative bent the world's leaders are gravitating towards, the church is going to return to a level of rigidity in the name of Christ. That will make me incredibly sad. I want to put a pin in that and bring in a caller we have on the line, Bobby Hill, is on the line. Bobby actually sang for the Pope in 2015. Bobby, you're on Studio 2. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I am good, Bobby. I want to just ask you, how did that moment change your life?
I mean, that moment was something that I'll never forget. I mean, it was a last minute thing, and I was able to sing for the Pope and meet him, and he gave me a gift, and I was just able to be there in his presence, and I'm so grateful for that. And something that I'll never forget, and I've had so many opportunities come from it and all of those things. But yeah, it's something that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
And you were what, 12 then? How old were you?
I was 14.
You were 14 then. And yes. As a young person, witnessing the Pope in action, you know, you talked about how it sort of changed your life. Can you talk about how that changed? And what did you talk to him about? Because you got a chance to meet him and speak with him.
I mean, yeah. I met him. I gave him a gift that my choir had brought back from Antarctica. It was a rock. And I gave it to him. He just asked if it was for him. And he said, thank you. And then I was, like, frazzled because it was last minute and I was in front of all those people. So I just
14.
Was, like, running off the stage, basically. And then he called me back and gave me a blessed rosary in, like, a red velvet box with the Vatican seal. Mm.
Great memories there from Bobby Hill recounting his meeting with Pope Francis when the Pope came to Philadelphia in 2015. Thanks for the time, Bobby.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, yeah, Cherry raised this question, this comment from Elizabeth, who feels like the church will go in a more, quote-unquote, conservative direction with its next pick. Break it down for us, Michael Moreland. What are the considerations, and who do you really feel like are the major contenders here?
Yeah, I'm not sure it helps to think in terms of conservative liberal. Yeah. Again, I think the important question is, you know, to speak the truth, that the Pope is a leader of an organization, obviously, but also is this face of Jesus to the church and to the world. And whatever man the conclave comes upon is the one to do that, I think, is the key question. I think, as our former Archbishop Chaput, though, said recently, this time is a time for candor as well, and to talk about some of the challenges that the church is facing, and some of the chaos that is, you know, is in the world, and
what
also,
do you see
also
as that?
In the
what
church.
Do you see as that candid assessment? You know, like what is the chaos? What are the struggles? There's definitely been some headbutting between Francis and the bishops here in America, correct?
Right. And I think, you know, having doctrinal clarity, understanding that doctrine develops and responds to the times in which the church exists, but having clarity about certain doctrines and certain ways in which the church. I mean, I understand that a lot of your listeners think that the church should, quote unquote, liberalize, and I would just point to the example of the liberal Protestant churches that all across the board went in that direction, and
sort of
and
the mainline Protestant churches, and they've lost.
They've collapsed, and so I think it. You know, thinking in those terms, I think it has some limits sure. But in terms of the candidates, I mean, someone mentioned Cardinal Tagle, for instance, who's the Archbishop in Manila, and then there are some that, you know, people talk about as quote unquote more conservative. Should they go back to a European? Should they go, you know, back to Latin America or as they did, or Africa? And so I think over the next 10 days or so, we're going to hear a lot of ins and outs. But as the saying goes, he who enters the conclave of Pope comes out a cardinal, and that even some of the people we might think of now as likely choices might not emerge. In fact, I think not many people thought that Francis was likely to win be elected in 2013. Ratzinger in 2005 was probably a little more likely because he was so senior. And then before that, in 1978, John Paul II was a complete shock because he was the first non-Italian.
You never know until
centuries.
The white smoke, right? So, but let's talk about what I think that one of the questions I have is, what really are the choices here? So a lot of our listeners are saying conservative, liberal. But going back to what you talked about earlier, Massimo, is it more of a choice between European orientation and global orientation? Because I have read that a lot of the major leaders from, for instance, the Catholic Church in Africa might come across as more conservative to an American audience, and yet that might be kind of the progressive direction if you think about where the church is growing and has opportunity. So what do you see as sort of the basic choices here?
So usually we tend to imagine the possible outcome of the conclave beginning with candidates.
Yeah.
Like in American politics primaries.
Right.
The conclave works in the opposite way. So first, the cardinals, they talk about what is the agenda, it's on the plate of the Catholic Church. It's the agenda that makes the candidates, not vice versa, right? Mm. And so, of course, within that agenda, which might be religious freedom in many countries, or social action, or pushing back against fascism in some countries, that fits certain kinds of candidates. And so the criteria are the usual ones: age, not too old, not too young, nationality. It shouldn't create problems for the Vatican diplomacy with big powers. If he's a member of a religious order or not. Usually in these last few decades, it has helped being a member of a religious order. And what's his record on some important issues, like the sex abuse crisis, for example. What he has said, what he has done, what his public reputation. So there are many, but the most important thing is the agenda, what they talk about, what is the center of the discussion. Then you have some possible candidates.
Do we have any clues as what that agenda is? And then my follow-up question is, we're at a different time, and there's a lot of outside influences, right? Social media. Media is so fragmented. Is that reaching inside of the conclave at all?
That's a growing problem, because there are no laws that actually regulate external influences within the college in the days before they are actually in a separate place. So no one is in charge of setting the agenda. It's a mix of human interaction, conversation. It's a mix of mass media influence. It's a bit of the Holy Spirit. So there is no one who officially says this is what the conclave is supposed to talk about, right? It's the mystery of the institution, which is 1,000 years old.
And what does your gut tell you? I mean, you both have been following the church for a long time. Will this next person be someone who continues Pope Francis started, at least starting these conversations, moving the church to a more inclusive space, or will it be something totally different? Any ideas? Michael?
I'm just, we'll wait to find out.
But here's the big thing that Michael brought up, though, and I'm going to get this in response to a comment here. Teresa says, I'm still a practicing Catholic. It was because of his liberal and inclusive leadership that I stayed faithful. With his death, the more conservative will rally for a pope aligned with their thinking, leading more people to leave the church. However, what Michael brought up is that we have seen this type of liberalization among mainline Protestant denominations in this country, and it has not revived their fortunes, at least in terms of membership. Is that a real risk for the Catholic Church here? You become too align with the times, and you alienate people because they don't find something sort of eternal and, in a sense, rigid in the doctrine, in the faith, and it feels unrooted. You know what I mean? Massimo, is that a real risk here?
It's a real risk in the mind of many, for sure. I think there's another risk right now, which is typical of our age, which is the age of identities.
Yes.
Of the culture clash.
Polarization.
Of reducing Catholicism to a cultural brand, to my personal identity, which means Latin, which means something. I mean, I grew up studying Latin. I have nothing against Latin. But if you reduce Catholicism to that's my cultural brand.
Yeah.
And so here there is a fine balance between openness to human dignity of women, of all people who were created in the image of God, and keeping some cultural content, which is essential to give you a sense of who you are, where you belong, right? But we are now in a very strong temptation of making of religion just another hashtag in our bio. And this is what Pope Francis really tried to help us say, no, it's about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And every day, it's a new story of how you live that.
But we did see this type of polarization when you looked at his, for instance, his poll numbers in America, right? Over time, conservative identifying Catholics had a dimmer opinion of him. And maybe that's just America. I don't know, Michael. This is some closing thoughts here. Is that just America where that happened? Or is this like a, are we seeing political polarization come to define what the Catholic Church means to people? Maybe that's not even reversible. I don't know.
I think that's true to some extent, and it's mostly unfortunate for all the reasons we talked about. But I do think that whoever is elected, and you know, I hope and pray it's a success, I guess, as being a Catholic, I have to believe that.
Yeah.
But I do think that, if, for instance, in the United States, as I mentioned, I think there's growth among more conservative communities. Priests who are under 50 are
much
are
more conservative.
Very for the most part. I mean, obviously, speaking in generalizations here. And so managing that, and we're just talking here about the American context, but managing that on a global scale is why it's such a challenge to find a candidate. But we trust that the Holy Spirit will guide the conclave to the right choice.
Because this is a world religion, right? Mm-hmm.
And it's
what
a tough
might
job.
Make Americans happy may not work in other parts of the world. Such an interesting conversation.
Well, what made me happy was this conversation today on Studio 2. Thanks to you both, Michael Moreland, Professor of Law and Religion at Villanova, and Massimo Fagioli, Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova. We apologize to all the other Catholic institutions in the region. You will be represented in future conversations. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.